All right, welcome to the CDOT Show. I am Paul Daner Jr., and you're saying to yourself, where's Josh Sneed? I like Josh Sneed. I don't want this Paul guy. But Josh,
that's what I said this morning.
Yeah. Josh Sneed celebrating his anniversary. So I am here pitching in, moving over from my Bengals work to pinch hit. That's the term we use here in baseball land. We're talking about the CDOT Show. We have a special guest here, of course, C. Trent Rosecrans, because his beard is on the poster. You're all very well aware of who he is. And we have our special guest, Mike Cameron, is with us. Let's hear it for Mike. Yeah. Absolutely.
So do the little intro that we had this discussion earlier when we were talking about Mike. Mike was a longtime coach at Moeller High School.
I've got a whole list of numbers if you'd like me to run through them.
Let's run through the list. Basic.
Here's the thing about 38 seasons you were the head coach at Moeller High School?
39.
My math is – I went to Moeller,
well,
so that explains
that.
Well, you
went to Moeller. That's
the problem. So 39 seasons. You produced 11 big leaguers. 30 of players you coached were either drafted or signed. 130 players – went on to play in college. You produced 767 wins and 4 state titles in those 39 years. Now, here's the impressive list, though. Here's the 11.
Let's see if he can name the 11.
Can you name the 11 big leaguers that you coached to come out of Moeller High School?
Babe Ruth.
One.
Ty Cobb.
Yep.
Stan Musial.
It's an impressive list.
Yeah, that's really good.
And I'm 108. Yeah. So. well, let's see. Yeah, Buddy Bell.
Yep.
Len Matusik.
Yep.
Billy Long.
Yep.
Pitcher. Yep. Barry Larkin.
People might know him.
Ken Griffey.
Jr. Also might know him.
There's Andrew Brackman.
Correct.
Eric Sirkamp. Adam Heisadu.
Yep.
You're missing two easy ones.
Mike Bell.
Yep.
David Bell.
One more.
Well, Steve Larkin was up.
Steve Larkin played in named all 11. That is correct. And that, folks, is an impressive list. Let me tell you the real crazy number about that list. Those 11 players have played a combined 9,448 Major League Baseball games from one coach and one high school.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. Remarkable.
Yeah, and this is from a football school.
Right.
Well, and academic, obviously.
Academic powerhouse.
It's the Ivy League of the Catholic schools.
I've always felt that.
Right, living proof there.
But, that's an impressive list, but there's one thing that is left off of this list, and that is in the year 1996, you cut me.
Well, I think that just gives credibility to my coaching.
Yeah.
You knowing your limitations, which you can't do anything with.
Right.
I don't think you understand how hard you slashed my hopes and dreams of an athletic career. I thought I was going to be I was going to be the next Adam Heisadu. I was going to be the next David Bell. But then I didn't even make it past my freshman year tryout before you... Not only did you slash my hopes and dreams, but then you sent me down a path of journalism that I'm in now.
Oh, my gosh.
And the only career that's considered better than it is lumberjack, I just found out yesterday.
And that's insulting a lumberjack.
It really is. I just want to thank you for that, though. You knew what you were doing, though. You clearly knew what was happening.
Believe me, you're not the only one that holds that grudge.
Do people approach you all the time bringing up these types of situations? I hope I'm not the only one.
They do. And when they said, well, I went to Moeller, and then I kind of hold my thought, and I say, was it a good experience or bad experience that you remember me? And if it's, sometimes they do say, you cut me. And... But you know, I've always, and we have a lot of kids come out for the baseball program, and it, without a doubt, it's the toughest job that any high school coach has. But we always try to do it in a dignified way, in a way that a kid still can hold his head high and have self-esteem. And
it took me about 10 years, but I got past it.
You know, the therapy paid off.
Absolutely.
Didn't it?
Yeah. It did. It did.
Medication. Yeah. All that.
Well, beyond my own personal life struggles, let's talk. I think people here might want to hear about Ken Griffey Jr. because what it had to have been like when you first saw him play. When did you first realize, okay, this guy is not just Ken Griffey's kid. He might be better.
Well, he was. I did find myself watching him play, and I would just be in awe. I mean, instead of being involved in the game, I'd see him track down. Really, the most amazing thing was to watch him track down fly balls. And I mean, you just don't normally see that type of athlete playing in Greater Cincinnati, much less you coaching him. And so that was always an amazement. But really, the first time he came up, we have hitting stations and we had tees, and he got on the tees and he missed about the first three pitches, and I'm thinking, holy, this is the great Ken Griffey that I've heard so much, because I had heard about him from his seventh and eighth grade coach that boy, this kid's a no doubter and so forth. So when I saw that, I thought, wow, we got a lot of work to do here. And but then we got into the cages and live hitting, and then you saw that classic.
So it was always like that?
Always.
That
always,
swing was
that
just
swing.
No. That's not what you say, Mike. You say
no. I
it was a
it
mess.
I, right. He was a right-handed hitter.
He was a right-handed hitter, and you
right-handed
said, try
hitter,
left-handed.
Crossed his hands, wanted to play soccer, and I said, kid, you got a future in baseball. No, but he was just, I think Sports Illustrated had an article, The Natural.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that's it. That's exactly what he is. He just did everything so effortlessly.
We hear stories. And when I went to Moeller, I remember hearing the legend. And it's like, you know, the legend, you wonder how much is grown over the years. Well, no, he hit it this far. Oh. But the stories of home runs going across streets and over buildings, and you know, it grows. But what is there one that you can verify for us today was one of the, you know, one of those stories is true?
Yeah, there was. I'll never forget the one down in. We were playing Norwood, and we were playing down at Dirt Park, and. He hit one that cleared the fence, cleared the trees, and cleared a building that was down on Sherman. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Norwood, but it cleared it. And our players were kind of used to seeing some of those drives, but I always liked to listen to the opposing bench. If I was on third base and their bench was on the third base, you would hear, holy shit. and it was just so funny to hear their reaction. Yeah. And many times Kenny would swing at the first two pitches and miss it and look badly. And then you could see this kid on the mound kind of puffing out his chest and thinking, I'm going to blow this fastball right by him. And then so it was kind of neat to follow him, and he definitely was by far the most talented player that I ever coached, and obviously probably one of the most talented in Cincinnati.
There's probably a number of major league managers who say the exact same thing. I mean, and you talk about it, that came on the heels of having Barry Larkin.
Yeah, I'm trying to get there. I think Barry was 82 and Griffey was 87.
Yeah,
you know, and it's really two highly accomplished professional baseball players who probably, of course, Barry's already up there, but in Cooperstown, but Kenny was going to be up
there.
Good
shot.
Yeah. I got my reservations already. But Barry, you know, really worked hard on it. Barry wasn't as natural with the baseball skills. Very natural, talented athlete.
Right.
Who was an All-State, All-American football player. Could have been the same in basketball if he really wanted to go that route, but he chose baseball. But by his junior, senior year, the secret was out. He was very, very talented. And I can remember he went to Michigan, and the Michigan coach, Bud Middall, was talking to me, and he said he had signed, committed to Michigan, and Bud told me, he said, I'll never see him. I said, what do you mean? He says, he's going to get drafted, and they're going to throw so much money at him that, you know, he won't go to college.
You didn't think? Did you think that was a possibility?
Back
he
then
he would get drafted that highly.
Yeah. And the only reason I can base that is I didn't always trust my own ability to judge it because I've only locally. I don't see the talent throughout
right.
the United States. But I based it on what the scouts would tell me. And, you know, they were telling me that, you know, is he signable? Will he go if we draft him? Will he forego college? And, you know, those are the type of questions that they want to know, you know, if a kid is going to be a high draft. Will he sign or are we wasting our draft pick? But anyway, Bud Middall said he won't go to Michigan. And I said... I don't think you know Mrs. Larkin. And she says, he said, what do you mean? I said, she's bound and determined that all her boys, and they had a daughter, they're going to get a college education. And sure enough, he got drafted number two and still was offered a lot of money. But Mrs. Larkin just said, you know, no, you're going to school and that's where he went. And Barry was able to do the kind of impossible, go to college, experience the college experience. I think he was in the World Series, College World Series, and get drafted higher than he was as a high school talent. And that's hard to do. He was the number one draft of the Reds coming out. So that's really hard.
Was he a better football player or baseball player?
Well, you know, it was really a privilege to coach them. I coached football for 18 years along with my baseball, and I had the opportunity to coach them 3 years in the secondary and then also 3 years on the baseball. So I got to know him very well. I got to know the family, and boy... he could hit you. I mean, he could close and just, you know, I think he could have played pro football.
He made a good decision.
Yeah, it worked out.
Yes, 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 definitely.
I think there are a lot of people here who are very happy that he chose baseball over football.
Yeah, me too. It was fun watching him for 19 years. And, you know, and he just represents the Reds, the city, Moeller, his family so well.
And that's a special family. I mean, you look at that. I mean, Steven was on that list as well, but also Mike Larkin, Byron Larkin, and then I'm sorry, I don't remember their sister's name.
I don't know if it was Julie or she couldn't play baseball. She couldn't.
She got cut.
She couldn't get.
She was like one of those people like Paul. You just don't remember them because they didn't play baseball.
Very forgettable.
we tried to get her in Moeller, but she didn't pass the gender test.
Yeah, that's too bad. Yeah. But that family.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about his mom, and the coaches in Michigan didn't realize her mom. But how much of you talked about his hard work and all that, and you look at, you know, Mike and Byron. And Stephen and what they did. How much was that from the family? And how much is that influenced some of the guys that you see on the baseball field?
Oh, I think it's big. It's really big. You know, naturally they had talent there, but the family values, the character values that they taught were just unbelievable. Just a real strong family, mom and dad, just the way it should be. And, you know, we benefited from that because he came in. Barry was a hard worker. You know, he didn't put on any entitlement attitude on you. And he was just fun to coach. Very likable. I mean, good in school. Not a problem that way. So it makes all the difference. Whether it's Barry Larkin or the last kid on the varsity now, what the parents.
The guy who's a little better than Paul.
Yeah. Was at least two cuts better than me, yeah. I'm curious about this. You know, when we mentioned the 9,448 games, and to see that as a coach has to be amazing. But you were able to – you went to Cooperstown when Barry was inducted.
Yes, yes.
What's that like? As a when you saw a kid from the age that you did, and you were such a part of molding his baseball career, when you're sitting there watching him give a Hall of Fame speech, what goes through your head at that point?
Well, and I went up with I had a great assistant, Paul Smith, and maybe you know him as a counselor.
I do. Yeah.
And 29 years, Paul was with me, and you know, he gets much of the credit. I get way too much of it, and he did a lot of the work, and I get the credit. But Paul and I went up together with our wives, and we just kept telling each other, you know, is this believable that we coached a kid that's in the Hall of Fame? And just, it's, you know, I walked away with just feeling I was so lucky. You know, yeah. That my career, I just can't believe that I've had the career that I've had. Yeah. Because I was no special baseball talent, and I was just trying to be a good high school coach. Matter of fact, I'll never forget the I was hired as a football coach by Jerry Faust, but I told him I wanted to coach baseball because I really enjoyed baseball. I wasn't that talented as a baseball player. I went to UC on a football scholarship. So after I was named, after 1 year of coaching JV, I was named the baseball coach, varsity coach. So I went to a state clinic, baseball clinic up in Columbus, and I started sitting down, and I really thought I knew something about baseball. I thought, I know how to organize a practice and teach these kids how to do this and that. And then I sat there and I listened to these college coaches, and each coach, I just kind of kept shivering, going, oh my gosh, we got to do that. We got to defend this and this. And I literally walked out of there, Paul, thinking, we'll never win a game. I mean, I was convinced, and this one coach, local coach from Harrison High School, he said, well, you're the new coach at Mueller. I said, yeah. I guess I started crying on his shoulder. And he sat down with me for, you know, about an hour and a half and just kind of said, hey, you know, you can do this and that. So, you know, you learn as you go along. And I did. And I'm fortunate to have a lot of good assistants and a lot of good players.
Yeah.
Buddy Bell had to be on one of your first teams just doing the math.
He was. 69, the first varsity team I coach, and this is a true story. Every time I see Buddy, I remind him of it. He knew more baseball than I did, and I remember we were at a game, and I had a football mentality that you know, we should score every time, and you know, why can't you field that ball? And Buddy pulled me aside, and he says, "Coach, we're not gonna get a hit every time. Just relax, coach." And that's not only Buddy, but his sons. I coached all three of his sons, and they were all the same way. They just had a great baseball mentality. They just knew how to approach a good at-bat, a bad at-bat, making a good play in the field, making a bad play. They knew how to do that. And an interesting sidebar. to it when I was in high school, my freshman and sophomore year, I was a clubhouse boy for the visiting team down in Crosley Field, and I think that's kind of where I fell in love with the game. And Gus Bell was a Red, and Gus Bell would at Old Crosley Field, they had the visitors clubhouse, and then you would have to walk by from the parking lot, the visitors clubhouse, into the Reds clubhouse. And I would be out there, and Gus would come, and he would come with four or five of his kids. And, of course, Buddy was one of them, but, you know, they were little then. And I struck up a relationship with Gus because he was just real friendly, and he would always say hi. He didn't know who I was, but, you know, he just would say hi to me. Well, about, what would it be, about 8-10 years later, here I am coaching his son, and I said, do you remember me? And of course, I think he just lied about it. He said, sure, I remember you. And Gus would, and I was a little intimidated, not a little, I was a lot intimidated by Gus Bill being at the games. You know, here's a pro player, and I'm thinking he's checking me out and saying, what the hell is he doing? And I remember I came to Gus one time, and I said, hey, how about talking to the kids about hitting? And he said, no. He says, Coach, he says, they're all yours.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I had my day in the sun, and he says, I'm going to sit out there in right field. And that's what he would do, sit out in right field. Many times he wouldn't even get out of his car. And the only thing he would do was if Buddy would get a hit, he would hear a little tap on the horn.
Yeah.
you know, and other parents are there trying to tell you how to do everything.
Right.
And here's a guy that could. And he said, nope. He says, that's you. He says, you do it.
You had at least one other major league son, major league dad as well. I mean,
Tabler.
Well, Tabler and Griffey.
And oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That Griffey guy.
I mean, well, Pat Tabler's boy's Tyler.
Right. Okay.
Tyler Payfield. And you know what? It's amazing. All three of them. And Dave Lapham's son played for me also. And all of them just understood what a coach goes through. And they really just stayed out of it. And when Buddy became a parent, he stayed out of it.
Oh, well, yeah, Buddy. I forgot the other one. Because Mike and
yeah. I mean, and I think they just appreciated what a coach is doing. And I would tell any parent this, you know, if you're thinking of sending them to Moeller, come in. I'll sit down and talk with you, explain everything. And you can ask any questions. But then once you enroll and once he becomes part of our program, it's, you know, get out of the way, let the coaches coach, and, you know, we'll do our job. I feel very confident in what we're doing.
But it's interesting to me that it was easier for the major league dads to take that advice than the some of the others.
Yeah, they do. And
because all the others, I'm sure, thought they knew more than you did, and then the guys who actually did.
Yeah.
Let you go.
Yeah, right. And because I think they knew what we were going through and how hard it is. And but still, I think it's just neat. That was part of the thing I enjoyed about coaching, is just the interaction with the parents and the different types of parents and kids.
That is not what I enjoyed about covering high schools.
No, the parents...
No. Paul did.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was great. You know what I'm curious about is you were talking about. I mean, you're talking about your first years coaching in the late '60s. You know, your early '70s, and now here we are. And Trent's could break down sabermetrics probably at some point here by the end of this. But for you, you know, watching the game. What's the biggest difference on the field in the way the game has changed over the years? I mean, it's obviously a different game, but for you, what's the biggest way that it's different now compared to what it was when you first started.
You're
going.
Talking on the high school level?
Yeah, or any level. I mean, even what you see every day.
Maybe I can address it more on the high school level. I think the kids are they get
spoiled. So they're terrible spoiled kids these days. Well, can say it.
Well, so many of them come from the thing now is that I have my pitching coach, I have my private hitting coach, my private fielding coach, and you have to learn to deal with that. The facilities that all the high schools have are so much better. You have indoor cages. And when I started, we never had an outdoor cage.
Kids shagging fly balls everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And usually it was one coach throwing and kids running around. Now it's just so much different that way. So the kids, they have a lot more instruction given to them. And
is that good or bad? That seems like that would be bad, actually, from your point of view.
Well, again, if all that was taking place when I first started out, when I probably, just to be honest, maybe didn't have the confidence in myself to where now when they started having a lot of this, I would try to work with the kid and say, okay, well, what is your instructor telling you? And then see what common ground there is and go from there. I mean, I'm not going to try to make every hitter, every fielder, every pitcher a cookie cutter. I try to work with what they have. And a lot of the instructors I've gotten to know just over the years, and some are really good and some, aren't so good. Well, I shouldn't say that.
They're terrible. They're awful.
No. It goes, and I'm not against players going to instructors because they can get so much more individual attention. You know, at a practice, I'm working with anywhere from 16 to 24 players. So a lot of times you can't give them the individual attention. Whereas if they go for 45 minutes to an instructor, it's one-on-one. And they get a lot of swings, a lot of instruction. So it's good. The only thing I think that can go that's tough for the parents in that is they pay a lot of money and they think that buys them a spot on the team. And
that's probably how I lost my spot. All those parents.
It's all your parents' fault.
They didn't pay.
Your parents didn't
I needed
spend
this personal
money.
Instruction. And I needed to, all these kids got bought onto the team. Yeah. That's exactly what happened.
Well, then I think the expectation is from the parent is that, well, my kid's been going to lessons. I can't believe he got cut. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing that I feel is really I kind of wish the instructors would be maybe a little bit more honest with them.
Yeah.
And would say, son, why don't you try soccer or basketball?
Right.
That swing will never make it.
Right.
But just what you told a young Paul Dana too.
Right. Essentially.
No, so, I mean, it's just they're, but but a player, the instructor, that's his livelihood.
Yeah.
And so he's going to lose a client there.
Well, now I see you most every day because now you are an official scorekeeper for the Reds. Or in Major League Baseball, or I don't know who signs your checks.
Major League Baseball,
Major League Baseball, yes. Let's make sure that is on there, that it is not the Reds paying your check.
That's right.
It is Major League Baseball. But how did does that just come about that they needed somebody and you obviously knew a little bit about baseball and could do that?
Well, of course, Ron Roth.
Yes, I know Ron Roth.
And I guess how it was turned over to...
Right, it was 1980. It was turned over from the writers to an actual employee or someone who was paid by Major League Baseball to be the official scorer. Because back in the day, it was sports writers and they didn't have to tweet or blog or anything, so they had time to do that crap.
Right.
Yeah, and they had time to do it, and the way I understand it, C-Trent, is that they found it kind of – they were under the gun when they would maybe give a shortstop an error and then come down and have to interview him, and the shortstop would blackball him.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, yeah. Not that you ever hear from players. I'm sure you've never heard from
a player. Never. No, but anyway, Ron Roth has been doing it for 36 years. So I think ever since it started.
Yeah, I think he showed me a video the other day of the first game he did, and it was like 1981 or something.
Right, yeah. He and Glenn Sample, and a lot of you might know Glenn Sample from the University of Cincinnati. Well, they were a pair that did it for years and years, and then Glenn Sample passed away about 6 years ago. And Ron Roth is one of the coaches, baseball coaches out at Mueller, and he's been there about 25 years. So when he needed somebody, and that year was my first year that I wasn't going to coach high school baseball. So he approached me, and at the time I was still teaching, he approached me and he said, would I be interested? And I said, well, let me think about it. And he told me a little bit about what it all involves. And so I thought about it, and I told him no. And then I came home and I told my wife, and I said, well, I told him no. And she looked at me. She said, are you nuts? She said, are all the baseball you've been doing and, you know, how much you love the game, and you're going to turn this down. This will be a great retirement job. And, I mean, she just ripped me. And then my son comes over, and he gets on me. So I said, okay. I called Ron up, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And I thought there would be, and here's kind of interesting, I thought there would be a test.
Right, you'd think.
No, yeah, you know, no test. And I remember talking to Major League Baseball, and they said, we will know whether you're good or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how baseball works, isn't it?
Yeah, right. They said, if we get complaints, you know, we'll no longer have you as one. So I spent that whole winter. And
you're still doing it, is the postscript.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, 6 years now. Yeah, but Ron Roth was really tremendous with me on that, along with Mike Jones. So the three of us, we always try to have two down there. And I'm down there about 60, 65 games a year, either in the number, what we call the number one seat, which is the official score, or the number two seat, where you help them. Just make the calls and help on the different stat categories. But Ron spent, you know, all of February and March just explaining the rules. And it was really an education to me because I thought I knew the rules about scoring. And I found out there was just a lot of stuff I didn't.
Is there one that sticks out, like the one that you thought you knew, and then all of a sudden you found out you're wrong?
Yeah, this is kind of a simple one. And say there's runners on first and second, and you have a double steal, and you throw the guy out at third. Well, I would always give the trail runner a stolen base. And the rule is no. If they throw out the one runner, the other runner is not credit with a stolen base. So it was stuff like that. You know, when you give an RBI, like on a double play.
Right.
No RBI, runner on third and first, double play. Runner scores, that's not an RBI. So it's stuff like that. Another interesting one of a ball hit to the first baseman. Pitcher comes over to cover, and the fielder, first baseman, throws him the ball, and it's right there and in time, and the pitcher drops it. It's an error on the pitcher, but you also have to give the first baseman an assist.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just...
Because if there's an error, it would have been a put out, so he gets an assist.
It's just kind of rules like that even though all the baseball that I had coached, you know, for 40 years, I never thought
I just remember yesterday, there was one that was like when Cueto was out of the box and bunted, and I'm like, how do I write that in the scorebook? And then, I, of course, you guys tell us. We have the little loudspeaker, those two on a, put out to the catcher unassisted. So I was like, oh, to you, you know, my scorebook. But there, how often do you have to go to the book?
I would imagine in a home stand, just to verify it, we might check it just to verify it. And then sometimes there's where we call Elias.
Right.
To see how it, and it was interesting. There was the play, and maybe some of you will recall it. There was runners on second and third, and Segrani hit a ball, and they trapped Mesoraco.
Yeah.
Coming off third in between home.
Yes, yeah.
They got him out, and then I believe it was Cozart they got
it
out.
It was Cozart. Cozart was the trail runner. He was on second, and he got caught.
And they so that was a double play, and we an official stat that we keep is grounded into.
Right. Okay, yeah, I remember this because I remember the announcement.
Yeah, so originally they said, well, that's it a grounded into? So they called Elias, and that's this guy's the king of the rules in New York. And Elias got on the phone and said, no, it's not a grounded into. And Mike Jones says, well, can you tell me the rule?
Right.
So I can, in case a sports writer,
some
somebody wants
sports
to
writer,
come
yeah.
up, wants to come up and challenge us. And they said, the guy said, no, I can't. And he said, well, what makes you think it's the rule? And he says, well, it's just the rule. And he's, so we're still not sure of it.
That makes sense to me.
But we have Elias's backing on it that it's not a. But that's one of those quirky things that.
But those come up like once a homestand.
Yeah, but we just want to make sure, and part of it is just an education. Mike Jones is really big into becoming an aficionado on the rules.
Yeah.
And you know, he can quote them, you know, 10, 16, A, B, and you know, and I'm.
You've heard from players during games, right?
Please.
Players, you've heard players from players during games, or like. Rob Butcher has.
Yeah, it's more Rob. Rob does a nice job of being a buffer.
Right.
Between us, and Rob's the media relations. And but I think they've been pretty decent about it. I know I've had.
Have you ever had like a run-in, like somebody come up to you?
No.
I've had some
phone calls the next day and just wanting me to explain it or. Which is, you know, okay, as long as you're civil about it. And
of course, because to you know, a fielder, that could mean a goal. Yeah, it could mean money, a gold glove, and then to a pitcher, it could be the same thing. I mean, it's on your ERA. So,
absolutely.
Especially in a free agent year. Those guys are probably a little more sensitive.
Yeah, and a lot of times with the pitching, you'll hear from the pitching coach. Because you know they're very protective of other pitchers, but 2 years ago, and I think it's 2 years ago, if a player has a beef now, they can call their agent, and they can turn it in, so they don't have to. They won't go through. They used to go through the media guy, and the media Rob would call us and say, "Will you look that?" Check
right,
because
you can still do it a day afterwards, right?
Right, you have 24 hours to change, and we have. We've done that because we'll get home and review the game, and if we think it needs to be changed, we do. Because we're under the gun to make a decision. Everybody's waiting from it, from the scoreboard to the TV, radio.
Most importantly, me.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. So everybody's waiting on it. So we try to make it as quick as possible with doing it right. And bottom line, that's all we want to do is get it right. And if we need to change, we'll change it.
Well, I can tell you this. Listening to many games up there, no one gets more indignant about
a scoring decision that they disagree with than Marty Brenneman. Nobody.
Yeah.
If you ever hear him on the radio, and having worked up there for a few years, every game is on the loudspeakers up there. He could, it's just something to talk about, I guess. He could debate this for innings. It could go on and on. So I assume when you come out of that room, does he cut you off at the pass before the elevator, or has he ever come up to you and asked about it?
Very first year I was, I had heard all those rumors about it, about Marty. Well, I've listened to him plenty on the radio. So when I went down there, the very first game, I think it was the center fielder, number three, Tavares?
Willie Tavares.
He lays down a bunt, and he gets thrown out, and we marked it a sacrifice. 1-3, and Marty wasn't on the radio at the time. He was on his break, and then all of a sudden he comes storming into the room and he says, "If that's a sacrifice bun, I'm a Chinese aviator." And I said, "Holy cow, man!" And so everybody has their opinion.
Yeah.
Just
Marty has a microphone.
Yeah. Well,
and an opinion.
He has an opinion.
He has, and if he finds out he's wrong, we never hear him say, "Well, I was wrong on that."
No.
The great thing is, I think the next year, I played in a softball league, and there was a group of Reds employees on a Sunday that had a softball team, and the team name was the Chinese Aviators.
Yeah.
They had T-shirts and everything, yeah.
I think that's where it came from.
Yeah.
I really do, that when he barged in on us. But I enjoy that. Jim Kelch is very knowledgeable of the rules, and a lot of times at dinner before the next game, there's a lot of talk, and we'll talk to Chris Welsh, Jim Kelch, the Cowboy. What did you think of that call? And that has really helped me when I hear them explain what they thought. Hal McCoy's been a big help.
Yeah, it's funny. In spring training, it goes to the Reds PR or the home team's PR department.
Right.
And so often it'll be a poll. Yeah. And because spring training counts don't really count. And so it's like you'll find out who's a tough grader and who's not. And it's just like, you have the thumbs up or thumbs down. My mother was the toughest. I don't ever. I remember when I was in Little League, lots of E5s for me because...
Yeah, I'm sure it was your mother that was the problem there. It wasn't you actually committing.
It was her.
E5s.
Trust me. No. She could talk to Mike and she would be wrong. She would not admit it. But
all right, let's hear again from Mike. And we'll take a quick break here and then we'll have some questions.
We're good. All right. Now we're going to do a couple questions. And I know there's got to be a couple of these and we just heard that they're... I've had a bet a debate for years, and this is just the guy to settle it. So, any questions? Step on up, and ma'am, are you first? Awesome.
I'm here to ask a question on behalf of all of us who sit in the stands and keep our own score.
Nice. Yeah. Let's absolutely.
I don't think that the baseball gives us the respect we deserve. They don't get the official score up on the scoreboard for us to see. This year, the Reds are finally putting up the pitch count, which I appreciate. That's the first year they've done that. But they don't put a controversial play. They don't put up your decision. So we can see what you're doing. So I'm hoping you have some influence in that regard.
If he doesn't, Paul does.
I have not much. But the pitch count has been up. It's on.
Yeah.
It's definitely up on the ribbon boards.
Yeah.
And
been on the lower left
side. Yeah, right where the speed
left
is.
Field.
Right, but it's much more obvious this year.
Okay.
It's much better presented this year. The scoreboard has changed.
I agree
yes.
with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It is
once they got rid of Paul.
Yeah.
Paul used to work on the scoreboard.
As soon as I left,
it got better.
The Inquirer, things improved dramatically.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
I take full responsibility for that.
Do they put it up the, like, you know?
I don't work there anymore, Trent, so I don't know what they're doing now. I know in the past they have flashed up what it was, Eve, and they're usually pretty diligent about that type of stuff, flashing up whatever the actual score was on a play. But I don't know that it is up. It's definitely not up there permanently, and I don't know that how they'll go if they wouldn't go to that. I don't think.
No. One nice difference though this year is with the advent of replay, they're showing more controversial plays on the replay board. And they're showing the...
They weren't allowed to in the past. Major League Baseball, because we heard this all the time in the scoreboard, is people will complain about, why don't you show the replays of that close play? You couldn't even show swing and miss strikes because it would embarrass the umpire, or you can't give away any secrets of what the pitch was. There are certain strikes you couldn't show. No swing strikes. You couldn't show where it was because it could embarrass the umpire. And the same way with close plays, MLB said you could not show any close plays at all. It had to be, it has to be obvious. Or one-time, real-time speed. You couldn't slow it down or anything
like
that.
But that has changed now.
Now with replay, you're allowed to show everything. And to their credit, the Castellinis have always been fighting to have this be the case. For years now, they've won it. They always said, just play it. Push the limits till they tell us we can't. That was always pretty much the deal. And so they've always wanted to bring the better experience they can to the fans. However, Major League Baseball at a certain point puts their foot down.
Well, thank you for keeping score, because it's just nice.
Do you were you down there at Riverfront? Did you follow the Reds when they were playing at Riverfront?
Oh, sure. Oh,
yeah. Okay, now I remember down there on the scoreboard, it came up, official score,
right,
E6.
Right, right.
And Ron told me that was... just kind of aggravated people with boo, so they just kind of did away with it.
I can't speak to that, but I appreciated it.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you
for your question.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right, who's next? Step it up.
Step up.
All right. There have been some pretty controversial calls in the past. One that really comes to mind is the perfect game that one of the Tigers pitchers had that was called incorrectly and he lost the perfect game. Is there any way on a score sheet where you can make a comment or anything that officially notifies that the call was incorrect? And I know that a lot of this has been solved with the instant replay, but there's still instances where, just the other day, Billy Hamilton stole second, but they called him out. They didn't challenge it. But that's probably not reflected anywhere on the score sheet, is it? Is there any way where you can, notify people in the future that he actually was safe?
You just put in BS over top of it.
Yeah, but it doesn't come along our official job description. It would be more a personal comment. And I think I would get in a lot of trouble with the umpires association. Sometimes they can be pretty arrogant. and I don't have direct contact, but just we have to rely on them telling us by signs changes.
Right.
And some are very good. They look up, they find you, and they tell us. Others, it's just, with their back to us, just kind of go. And we don't know, and then we have to look around, find out where a new player has come in, new sub. So no, we would never put that comment that it should have.
All right, here it is.
Here's the decades-long debate question. So early on in the game, before anything's going on, a foul ball happens, and a player on an ordinary effort makes an error on a foul ball. That's ruled in the air. Through the rest of the game, pitcher goes on to throw a perfect game. Is that still considered a perfect game? Do you go back later? Do you remove the air? How does that go? And, for Paul and Trent, what's the reaction to that if, Mike says, no, it's still an error, it's not a perfect game?
Does it does it have to, like, well, then the guy, the heir is retired.
You know, that's yeah, the heir is retired. I mean, they face 27 batters. There's 27 putouts. That's a good question does that count as a perfect game? Nobody got on base, no hits, 27 putouts in a row. So,
well, it's the answer, Mike.
I say, Mike, you're not helping me. This is a decades-long
debate.
Well, that's
when I call Elias. Believe me, I have him on my speed dial. But that
I think it would count. Because it's a perfect game for the pitcher, not for the team.
Right.
That's a guess. I am not Elias.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was a pitcher, I would say I threw a perfect game. I could
yeah,
that
I'd
much.
Be like, screw you.
Yeah, I don't I care threw a perfect how you're game. Judging it. You I'll know. Get a plaque made and everything. It's cool.
All right, we got anything else? All right, one more.
This actually a two-part question. Have you
two
ever,
more.
Have
two
you
more.
Ever been thrown out of a game as a high when you were a high school manager? And two, what was the greatest play you ever saw on a baseball diamond in general since in your 40 years?
Wow. You know, I have flashes as far as the greatest play. I have flashes of Barry Larkin going deep in the or back of second base, spinning around and throwing runners out that you just don't see it. You know, you don't see it all the time on a professional. And here's a 17, 18-year-old kid doing that, and, you know, he wears the Mueller blue and gold. I saw Ken Griffey run down balls that just, you know, unbelievable. now I lost the other question.
The other question was,
ever been thrown out of a game?
I hope so.
One time. And it was in a phys ed class. It was one game, and I challenged the umpire, and he, you know, drew a line, and he said, "Don't pass that." And so I thought, "What the hell is that? What do you mean, don't?" So I passed it, and he says, "You're out. You're thrown out." So
in 39 years, you were thrown out.
That was
one
the
game?
Only time.
One time. Well, you know.
So in my 4-year high school playing career, I equaled you.
Yes. Well, in high school, you lose that game plus another game.
My coach made that decision too.
You know, and I, you know, yeah. Yeah, you know, I just thought it was more important to stay in the game. Umpires, you know, I thought I knew my limits. A lot of times to go out there, run out there and argue, I'd get out there and I'd say, "Now what the hell do I say?" So I just said, "The heck with it."
I still hold a grudge against Terry Eckmark. That was the umpire's name.
Wow, remembering old umpires' names from your high school
career. It was called third strike against ASIJ, low pitch.
Wow.
Junior
year. Can we move on? Anybody have a question?
One more question.
My question is more on coaching. Now, you've had a lot of great players come through you, and when those great players come along and then you have your ordinary players, like how do you reconcile, how do you coach up those great players where you think, what can I teach this kid, versus the ordinary players where you do have a lot of knowledge to give them?
You know, that's a good question, and I remember a player we had that was pretty good, Mike Alexa, that went on to a career at Duke and played in the minor leagues a little bit. He was being recruited by Stanford, and I called the coach, and we were talking, and we were talking about how you deal with very talented players. And he says, every kid I get is an All-American. I mean, it's just the nature of our school. And he said, I really can't coach him until he fails. And once he fails, once he goes 0 for 10, 0 for 12, then all of a sudden they come to me and say, "Coach, I'm having trouble with that slider. Can you help me?" Then I know I got him. Then I know I have his ear. And I'm just being honest with you. Ken Griffey, how much I taught him how to swing and hit, I don't think I did a lick. I, you know, my job was to get him on the bus, make sure he was on the bus. So,
yeah.
And no, but you know what? What I tried to do, get like Ken, just to appreciate his high school experience, what he was going through. The biggest thing with him was to try to guide him through the whole idea of the scouts being there, keeping that all in perspective. And believe me, there were scouts there all the time, general managers. Now, Kenny had the advantage of his dad that was also helping him a great deal. I made a living. I mean, I get a lot of acclaim for guys like Barry Larkin and Ken Griffey. But I can tell you, Mueller's success is based on a lot of what I call lunch pail ball players. Just the average high school kid that after high school didn't play any more ball. But they loved it. They loved being part of the program. I loved having them. And so, believe me, there was a lot more of those lunch pail guys. But I tried to help the kids where I felt I could help them. If it was that kid that had a shot at being a pro player, I tried to facilitate that in the whole process of the draft. If it was a kid that had the potential to play college ball, I wanted to help him through that process as far as how he could best expose himself to college programs, whether it be through showcases and that. And then if it was that kid that was at the end of the high school season, that was going to be it for him. I wanted him to have the best high school experience he could possibly have. So it depended upon the kid, and then I tried to facilitate that.
Most importantly, didn't want anything to do with Paul Danner Jr.
Yeah, what was your plan for guys you cut their freshman year? What did you do with them? What was your plan for them?
You forget them.
Yeah, you forget them, and you tell them to go write for the newspaper.
You know what, Paul? And I know we're having fun with that, but I tell you.
Just tell me you feel bad about it. That's all I need.
I do.
Now.
But one of the final things that we would tell a kid, especially a freshman, sophomore, is, hey, go out, play ball, love the game. You know, don't stop playing just because I said you can't play, be on the team. Go out, play, come back out. We encouraged him. I had a kid that I cut three straight years, and he ended up his senior year being a starting second baseman. Played 2 years down at Xavier University. As a freshman, he was about 82 pounds. As a senior, he was about 155. Strength, development, hard work.
I didn't have any of those things. I just went to the newspaper.
No, but on the serious, especially the young parents, at 14, you haven't developed. So we just... And there's been all type of success stories like that. The kids that got cut come back out, and they make the team.
Yep. All right, let's hear it again from Mike Cameron, everybody.
Thank you, Mike.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming out here.
Yeah, May 15th is our next one. Is that the right date?
May 15th is the correct date. Josh Sneed will be back.
Yeah.
Cracking jokes.
That's George Brett's birthday.
George, oh. Why do you know things like this?
I know. That's...
Oh, yeah, let's hear it for George Brett. I mean, I know he's your boy and all, but... Yeah.
And then June 12th is our other one. I just booked the June 12th, Kate. I can't announce the May date guest, but June, we got a good one.
Which you're not going to announce. You're just going to say it's a good one. And...
Actually, no. See, Mike, the question we forgot to ask, our Nick's question from earlier, best player you coached against?
Oh, boy, there! Wow, that's Tuffy Rhodes was awful tough.
That is our June guest.
Yes.
How about that?
No, he was. I mean, he's what a talented
synergy.
And
it is Full circle, Trent. Look at you.
Storytelling.
You know, I think he was right around Ken Griffey's.
Though. Yeah, they were around the same age.
Yeah. And I think he knocked us, Western Hills knocked us out of the tournament that year with Ken Griffey. And Dusty also pitched. Mm. And he came in to relieve that game. He had pitched the day before. But he was awful good.
Tough. You played in Japan, and
yeah,
this is the 20. It's been 20 years since he hit 3 home runs in opening day for the Cubs, which is the day where everybody said, "Who the heck's Tuffy Rhodes?" But yeah, so
I remember that my senior year of high school.
Absolutely. So that'll be in June.
Yeah.
So you come back here to Motor Pub for that and drink beer and listen to baseball, which I assume is a good deal. Let's hear for Mike Cameron one more time, yeah. And thank everybody for coming out here to Motor Pub and the C Dot Show.
Thank you, Paul. You. Thanks.
Wonderful. Awesome. Thank you. Enjoyed it.